The Guardian.
Europe cries foul as the UK reintroduces quarantine on arrivals from Spain. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
And let's be absolutely clear about what's happening in Europe, amongst some of our European friends. I'm afraid you are starting to see, in some places, the signs of a second wave of the pandemic.
On Saturday evening, as British holidaymakers might have been sipping a cocktail or two in Mallorca or on the Costas, the government announced that anyone arriving back from Spain would have to quarantine for 2 weeks. The response was angry, but the government stood its ground, with ministers telling people to keep booking holidays while accepting some risk that they might have to quarantine when they come back. But was the Spain decision rooted in public health or politics? We'll discuss it. 2020 has been a whirlwind for most of us, but given the year Boris Johnson has had, are we heading into the summer holidays with a very different leader than the one who entered number 10 a year ago? Has Johnson changed? Not everyone will be taking a break this August, but the Liberal Democrats know how to have fun. They're preparing for a leadership election. Later, Peter Walker speaks with one of the candidates, interim leader Ed Davey. And as the number of senior civil servants resigning continues to rise, Rajiv Sahyal discusses the impact of the Whitehall shake-up with the leader of the Mandarin's trade union. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, according to the government, anyone booking a holiday abroad should brace themselves for a 2-week quarantine when they get back to the UK. And as the Spain decision proves, you shouldn't expect much warning. The reason for the move was contained in the Prime Minister's declaration that a second wave is starting to swell on the continent, an announcement that European leaders might have been surprised to hear a British Prime Minister make. What's more, despite coronavirus clusters popping up, there's no evidence that what Europe is seeing is, in fact, a second wave. To discuss the government's response to Spain and everything else that's happened in Westminster this week, I'm joined by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. Jess, welcome back. It's been a while. We've missed you. How does it feel to be back and working?
Yeah, I mean, it's what a brave new world it is to be working in. I left just as Boris Johnson kicked those 20-odd MPs out of the Conservative Party for voting to stop a no-deal Brexit. And we're in quite a different world. I thought that was a seismic political moment. I think people barely remember that now, given the number of seismic political and other global moments there's been since then. So it is like a new world, but it's great to be back.
And that was in the period when we thought the biggest deal possible was Brexit and an election. And we've had both. And now, of course, a global pandemic is on our hands. So it is quite big. And now we saw from a whole variety of people, from the Transport Secretary Grant Shapps right through to our very own colleague John Crace, that there was some confusion and disappointment over the government's decision at the weekend to say that people coming back from Spain needed to quarantine for 14 days. It was a genuine surprise to people, wasn't it?
I think it was a genuine surprise, and no more so than to the tourists who arrived in Spain for their holidays thinking they'd managed to salvage something of their summer, and then to be told that when they got back they would have to quarantine for 2 weeks, something that is very difficult for people in a whole host of jobs. So yes, it's going to ruin a lot of summers, and there is a potential for more places to be placed on that list in the coming days. We don't know what those countries will be yet. One of them is Luxembourg. There may be fewer of British tourists heading to Luxembourg for their summer holidays, but still it might disrupt a lot of plans if more countries are added to the list.
The decision has been defended as being purely done on health grounds, the government saying they're just going to do whatever it takes to prevent resurgence in coronavirus cases. But there is this accusation that actually there's some politics in this. Tell us more about that.
I think that there is some politics involved in this. And I don't, you know, I think the government, you know, perhaps privately would admit there's some politics involved in it, because of the way that they were criticized in the beginning of the pandemic for not making decisions quickly and for not making decisions clearly. Now, this is a very clear instruction to British travelers, and it's also a very quick decision that was making when they, that they made when they saw how fast the trajectory was of cases rising in Spain. And you know, speaking to people today, they feel they've been absolutely vindicated in that. They look at the way that the Spanish cases are rising now, and they think it was the right move, and they think that if they'd waited a week or even 24 hours, then more people would have started coming into the country who had coronavirus, who were coming back from Spain. That we know that there was a handful of cases where that happened. So this is something the government was very conscious of. And yes, it's a political decision. They want to look decisive. I suspect they wouldn't even necessarily apologise for that. But it is something that we are told to kind of try and get back to normal and cautiously as possible. We're told to try and get out there and support the economy. And that means, you know, supporting the travel industry and booking our holidays and spending money. And now we're told, actually, hang on there, we've always said that we could pull up the drawbridge at any minute. And I don't think people really fully appreciated that when they started spending their hard-earned money on holidays.
Now, the premise for this decision, and we heard it at the top of the podcast, was the Prime Minister's suggestion that Europe is experiencing the beginning of a second wave. And our Guardian colleague John Henley points out that actually no European country themselves talks in terms of a second wave. And does that then suggest that in a way for the leader of Britain to step forward and make this announcement, as it were, for them, saying that they're having this second wave, is that going to go down well, or is that going to look like sort of British arrogance for it to fall to Boris Johnson to say how the Europeans are doing?
I mean, I did think it was a pretty extraordinary statement by the Prime Minister to kind of make that sort of universal judgment on behalf of a lot of European countries. And we do know that they are really quite concerned about a potential second wave. Maybe this is an attempt to kind of point to Europe and do a bit of expectation management about what might happen in the UK in the coming months. Of course, there's this debate about whether this is really a second wave at all. I mean, it seems like we might not be out of the first wave. You know, there seems to be a kind of constant rising and falling of cases depending on the management of people and businesses in lots of different countries, and that it just kind of goes up and down a bit with various spikes in different locations depending on circumstances. And so I think for the Prime Minister to universally declare that the Europe is now going to be in the grip of this second wave is a bit of an extraordinary thing to say.
Now, the other thing that may have put people off travelling abroad was this report from the Foreign Affairs Committee this week, saying that the Foreign Office had basically abandoned British citizens who were stranded abroad during the peak of the outbreak. And I'm just wondering what effect you think that might have and what's sort of behind that, and whether or not that sort of colours how we might view what the government would do if there is indeed another, you know, big surge, a big swell in this. And if people are left, you know, flights get cancelled, people are left stranded abroad, or if there are just, you know, ever more tightening of the quarantine arrangements, are the government kind of equipped for that?
Yeah, I mean, the report from the Foreign Affairs Select Committee that you refer to is pretty damning about what happened when there was 1.3 million British nationals who were stranded. And you know, basically they said it was extremely slow. There was no communication, and it also put that said that government cost cutting might be the reason for it. I suspect you probably wouldn't have an emergency of that nature the second time around. You'd have, I would suspect, far fewer Britons abroad, you know, if a similar crisis was to come along. But particularly, I think, when it comes to communications, I mean, we all saw and heard those stories of people who just had no idea when or they'd be able to leave the country, whether they could, you know, if all flights were cancelled, and yet they're all the only instruction they were hearing from the UK government was to get home, and they had no way of doing so.
Besides holidays and travel abroad, the other issue of the week has been obesity and the government planning a big new programme for tackling that. And yet, with odd timing, on Wednesday there was also a report that showed the government has to tackle food poverty, and these issues are linked. Is it difficult for the government to be talking about obesity and getting people to eat less while simultaneously fighting political fires about food poverty?
Yes, and I think that one of the big criticisms of the obesity strategy, which I think is really interesting, is that it basically focuses a lot on individual responsibility. So the choices you make and helping you make the right choices by, you know, not showing you really appealing adverts for delicious burgers or whatever it is during the day, or at least not when your kids might be watching and pester you for them. And it doesn't really focus on the kind of systemic problems of obesity and food poverty. There's very little that was in the obesity strategy, for example, about the formulation of kind of cheap ready meals, which some families might have to rely on, whereas, you know, the government seems very reluctant to interfere with that sort of thing, the amount of sugar and fat there is in food that people are buying. And so perhaps, you know, the obesity strategy could go further and could go some way to tackling the systemic problems that come along with the choices people make when they can only afford certain kinds of food to eat.
We were talking right at the beginning about the contrast between the political landscape you've rejoined to cover after 10 months away and how it looked 10 months ago. I mean, this week, there's the sight of Boris Johnson announcing an anti-obesity initiative. The Boris Johnson who took over a year ago from now, we all associated with being the libertarian, merry England Boris Johnson of his Telegraph columns. He's had obviously an extraordinary year, not just politically with the election victory and then the Brexit process, but also just in terms of getting himself mortally sick with coronavirus. Just putting it all together, do you think everything that's happened has genuinely changed him?
It's hard to know that at this stage when he's still kind of in the middle of firefighting a pandemic. And he says that there won't be any more nannying or bossying, a word he might have invented, you know, involved in encouraging people to kind of get back cycling, lose a few pounds. But no, it's not something that we would have expected. One of the things that I think that we'll truly need to see if there's a kind of new Boris Johnson is if there is, after all of this crisis, still a commitment to that levelling up agenda, which is the thing he sort of touted so hard during the election campaign, the promises he's made to those MPs who won those red wall seats. That's the thing that I think his parliamentary party are looking for now. And that's something that and how he handles the economic fallout of this crisis whilst promising to keep spending. And that's what I think we'll see him ultimately judged on, and also see whether he's really committed to the things he says he is.
I mean, the worrying thought about this notion of a Damascene conversion for him from his own experience of having more serious COVID because of his weight is that if it requires, I saw one wit remark this week, is this what it's going to take, you know, a lived experience for the Prime Minister to wake up? Is the Downing Street basement going to have to be submerged in water before he takes the risk of flooding seriously? You know, does he have to go through everything personally? It on one level, it's brought a lot of sympathy for him, but it is troubling if he doesn't take things seriously, unless he has himself had personal experience of it.
I think that that is something that people have repeatedly said about Boris Johnson's character, that basically he is as enthusiastic about the last conversation he had until he has another conversation. That is, I think, his personality and personal experience and also personal kudos seems to be the thing that really motivates this prime minister, which is infrastructure he can stamp his name on, things he can draw from his own personal life experience. And I think that will end up being quite a lot of the hallmarks of his premiership.
Jess Elgott, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
After the break, Rajiv Sial speaks to the head of the biggest union for UK civil servants about the wedge between this Tory government and seasoned Whitehall officials. Plus, Peter Walker talks to the Liberal Democrat leadership candidate, Ed Davey. We'll be right back.
Hello.
If I asked you to tell me a story about you,
hello,
what would you say?
He's got this like really weird thing in his head where he thinks I'm like a witch.
I'm Leia Green, and this is Innermost, a new podcast from The Guardian about strangers and their secret lives.
The curtain goes round the coffin. That feels very strange.
Listen now on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Innermost is supported by Vodafone.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, over the past 6 months, we've seen several high-profile civil servants resign. There's little doubt that some decided to leave due to a breakdown in their relationship with their political masters. Just look at Sir Philip Rutnam, formerly the Permanent Secretary at the Home Office. His resignation sent shockwaves through Whitehall as he accused the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, of bullying and proceeded to sue Patel and the Home Office over his treatment. She still denies any wrongdoing. Since then, we've seen Sir Mark Sedwill, the UK's most senior civil servant, step down. And most recently, it was announced that Helen McNamara, the senior civil servant in charge of that bullying inquiry into Priti Patel, would herself be moved. The Prime Minister's chief adviser, Dominic Cummings, recently warned that a hard rain would fall on Westminster, and it seems he wasn't kidding. But what will be the long-term effect of all this change? The Guardian's Whitehall correspondent, Rajiv Sayal, spoke with Dave Penman, General Secretary of the First Division Association, which represents senior civil servants. You might hear Rajiv's kids in the background a couple of times. The joys of recording from home.
Hello, Dave. Thanks for being on the show and great to have you. Reading your Twitter account, I see that you refer to the Prime Minister's senior adviser, Dominic Cummings, as Hard Rain Man after he claimed the hard rain would fall on Whitehall. What has his effect been on the workings of government so far?
I think it's been a very different type of government since Boris Johnson came in and brought Dominic Cummings in to government. A lot is attributed to Dominic Cummings, whether it is him, whether it's those around him. Ultimately, what he does with the authority of the Prime Minister. He's what's called a special advisor, which means that he's personally appointed by the Prime Minister and in a sense doesn't have any power. The only power he has is the power that the Prime Minister gives him. So if he is doing things to the civil service, if he is creating problems or he's changing things, it's essentially on behalf of the Prime Minister. It's clear they've been prepared to brief against civil servants in particular more readily. So more than anything, I think there's a different tone from this government, where rather than a kind of collaboration with the civil service, things that have been said, things that have been briefed in the media, things that have been written about in the past, suggests a much more kind of confrontational relationship between the top of government and the top of the civil service.
Select committees in the past have expressed some frustration with the pace of change amongst senior civil servants and how they sometimes move from one job to another with little accountability. Is there a possibility that Dominic Cummings is attempting to address that problem in some way? And is there any validity to those criticisms?
I mean, every big bureaucracy is slow. Ministers, every government comes in and gets frustrated at the pace of change. Some of that is because what government does is big. It's bigger than anything the private sector does. That doesn't mean they can't speed up. And there are a number of elements you talked about there. There's a lot of chum at the most senior levels of the civil service, and that's because pay is so poor. So the only way to get a pay rise is to move job. That's no surprise. Government knows that. They've known about that for nearly a decade, but they won't address it. I mean, the UK civil service is internationally recognised as the best civil service in the world. People talk about the Rolls-Royce civil service. It's not just a throwaway line anymore. You know, not only has the civil service done things like deliver the job support scheme where 9 million employees are now getting direct support from the government, you know, coped with a sixfold increase in claims to universal credit. It did all of that as it was transforming itself from an office-based organisation to a home-based organisation. So yes, I think any civil servant would say there are things that can change, there are things that can speed up. But we need to take that in the context of an awful lot of things that the civil service is doing well.
There's been so much churn in amongst the top jobs in the civil service just over the last 4 or 5 months. And I suppose the most prominent of those is Sir Mark Sedwill, the former Cabinet Secretary. He resigned or was pushed to resign, depending on how you look at it. And a Guardian reader wrote in saying, apparently any institution that dares to display its independence from the government is deemed to be treasonous and subversive and must therefore be cowed and bullied into compliance and servitude. Do you think Pete has a point, and is the government filtering out those they see as troublemakers?
I think there's a danger that that's where it's heading. I don't know whether it's there yet. I don't think anyone can look at the nature of the departures that have happened over the last few months, whether it's Sir Mark Sedwell or permanent secretary level, and indeed some below that, and think that that's simply a matter of kind of natural churn, people coming to the end of their tenures and going. There's clearly a tension there. And there's a real danger that government comes in, wants to change the personnel, you know, is worried about the people who existed beforehand, is suspicious about people who served the previous government. That's exactly what the civil service is there to do. It's there to have institutional memory. It's there to serve different ministers, different prime ministers and different governments. It makes it a more effective government. And I think that sense of whether it's just those who oppose, whether it's those they don't rate, whether it's those they're suspicious of, that kind of level of churn on the basis of trying to get kind of our people in, wanting to pick our own team, is not really good for any organisation, and it's not good for a civil service that is meant to be impartial and permanent for a reason. That's why the UK civil service is the number one civil service in the world, because ministers get that untarnished advice, and they get it because that civil servant doesn't have to worry about their job. You know, that if the minister doesn't like it or doesn't want that advice, that's fine. They don't have to take it. Ministers decide, civil servants advise. Now, if that changes, either deliberately undermining that in terms of changing the rules around how civil servants operate, or just by the culture and a culture of fear and worry that actually, if I don't tell them what they want to hear, then I'm going to be on the shit list and I'm going to be on the front pages of the newspapers, then that is not how you get good government. And I think there has got to be a real concern that that's where we're heading. There are too many departures, too many stories, too much going on that suggests that actually there isn't some truth in some of this.
Your union is representing Sir Philip Rutnam, Priti Patel's former permanent secretary, in an upcoming tribunal against Priti Patel and the Home Office. How rare is this, and what will be the crucial issues?
Well, I've been 20 years at the FDA, and it's not happened in those 20 years. And unprecedented is a word that's too often bandied about. It is completely unprecedented. Sir Philip, he's not the only one who's going in circumstances where it would seem it's not happy, it's not the kind of normal time, it's not as a result of just the circumstances of when people go. And it starts to feel like a bit of a purge. It starts to feel like the people that they don't value, they don't rate, they don't trust are being forced out one way or another. The Minister for the Cabinet Office, Michael Gove, made a speech a few weeks ago where he talked about the dangers of groupthink, kind of cognitive diversity, they talk about it. That's not what it looks like from where I sit. It looks like actually they want their people in. And that's not cognitive diversity. That's how you get groupthink. There's a wonderful line Lord Hennessy had where he said, a civil servant's employed for what they can do, not what they believe. And ultimately, if you just employ people who support your ideology, then that's where you get groupthink. That's where you get bad decisions. That's where there's a lack of challenge in the system. Might be more comfortable if you're a minister or a prime minister, but it doesn't make for better government.
Dave Penman of the FDA Union, speaking with my colleague Rajiv Sial. Now this week, members of the Liberal Democrats will start to vote for who they want to see as their next leader. A couple of months ago, The Guardian's Peter Walker spoke to one candidate, the MP Leila Moran, and earlier this week, he spoke to the man hoping to beat her to the top spot, Sir Edward Davey.
Ed Davey, thank you very much for coming on the show. We're speaking to you as Lib Dem members basically start to pick who the next leader is going to be. You are the interim leader. You're trying for a second time to be the permanent leader. This leadership election must be slightly strange. I mean, the last one you were kind of having, you know, proper meetings and seeing people in person. With this time, it's a kind of virtual leadership election. Could you just talk me through how that's been going?
Very different. We had a really great campaign with Joe and we went all around the country. That travelling experience with your team and, of course, meeting people in face was very, very different. And you got reaction to what you said at hustings on Zoom. It's very difficult. to gauge the reaction that you're having out there. You know, you can see a bit in the chat, a bit in messages afterwards, but not live. So that's very different.
I mean, and it's, you know, quite a hard thing to think about, but the general election was only about 7 or 8 months ago. And, you know, a subsequent internal party review called the Lib Dems general election campaign a high-speed car crash. I mean, what do you think, you know, as deputy leader then, as someone, as the interim leader now and going to become permanent leader, what do you think the general election of 2019 kind of taught you?
Well, I co-commissioned that inquiry and was really keen that Dorothy Thornhill did it and made it clear that I wanted a no punches pulled analysis and that it shouldn't just be about the 2019 election. Actually, I have felt for a long time that the problem started way back, certainly back to 2015, if not before. And so I strongly welcome the Thornhill inquiry, all 61 pages of it, all the main recommendations. And if I'm leader, I will be implementing that at speed. For me, it talks about everything from our failure to be diverse enough to our failure to use actually good campaign techniques where national campaigns have overridden local campaigns. So it's all there in black and white. Everybody can see it. And for me, it's about fundamental change. Because the reality is there are no quick fixes for where the Liberal Democrats are. No quick fixes at all. And the review makes that clear. And we need to rebuild by building firm foundations. And then we can be back in the game. Then we can be winning parliamentary seats and being part of a force to get rid of this Boris Johnson government.
And again, the kind of period since the general election has felt like a kind of time of quite a lot of change. Jo Swinson, who obviously led the party into the general election, lost her seat. You immediately took over. And basically we've had, you know, the pandemic taking over and, you know, we've had this kind of very strange political period. I mean, especially as an interim leader, how have you managed or tried to keep the Lib Dems within the picture? It'd be very, very easy after an election like that just to kind of, I don't know, fade into the background for a few months.
Well, it's very common after a poor general election performance that we had that the media take no notice of you. And even more so when there's something like the pandemic. I mean, even Keir Starmer, the sort of new kid on the block, has had problems getting coverage. So, you know, it's not surprising that we've struggled a bit. I like to think we've had one or two hits. I led the challenge on Dominic Cummings to call for him either to resign or to be sacked. I like to think we got a hit with my call for a independent public inquiry into the government's handling of COVID, where I was the first party leader to call for that. And then I extracted a commitment from the Prime Minister to hold such an inquiry. So it's been challenging, absolutely, Peter. But I think we've made some hits. And given the circumstances, it's not surprising that we're, you know, not doing as well as I would like.
In terms of the leadership election itself, so the Lib Dem leadership election is basically in process now. It's Leila Moran versus you. Leila has to an extent positioned herself almost, I guess, slightly to the left, saying she wants to make the Lib Dems more radical than Labour, where you have been in the party for longer and you were a minister under the Tory Lib Dem coalition government. Is it fair to characterise it as a kind of battle of, you know, the centre versus the left, or is there more to it?
Well, I'm a centre-left politician. I've always been progressive. I've argued in the party for higher taxes for investing in public services, for example. I've argued for really radical approaches to everything from climate change to civil liberties. So centre-left is where people would put me. Leila ultimately can speak for herself. I've been a little confused on her positioning, actually. Sometimes she's sort of said that she wants to go after the Corbynista vote and be more radical than Starmer. She did an interview with a New Statesman, which seemed to suggest she was still open to a coalition with the Tories. And I just didn't quite understand her positioning. But people can read what she said. I mean, she said in The Observer this weekend that she wanted would consider a joint campaigning force with the Labour Party, which I wouldn't. I disagree with her on that.
And I guess as the third party, then your relations with both Conservatives and Labour will play a kind of pivotal role in where you go. I'm right in thinking, aren't I, that you've ruled out any sort of kind of deal with the current Conservative government. But at the same time, I mean, the Lib Dems tend to do best when kind of Labour do well as well. I mean, could you characterise what your kind of hopes and aspirations for the two parties would be? Would you just never have anything to do with any Conservative government or a Boris Johnson-led one? Or would you collaborate at all with a Keir Starmer-led Labour Party?
Look, this Conservative government and this Conservative Party have gone to the right they're anti-European, they're nationalist and populist. They stand for everything that I'm against. I have to say, I really want to get rid of this Conservative government. I think they are appalling and shocking, and there's no way I can deal with this Conservative government or this Conservative party. And then the Labour Party, I mean, it's very interesting because at the last election under Corbyn, it was clear that they were taking the Labour Party to quite a hard left position. And with Keir Starmer, it already looks like there's a significant change, not just on the issue around anti-Semitism, but you know, I just get the impression that he wants to take the Labour Party into a, I would call it a more electable place, to be honest. And if that is the case, and I very much hope it is, then I certainly will want to see what cooperation we can have in opposing this government and what, where, if there are common areas that we can work on. At the moment, it's a bit earlier to go beyond that, because there'll be areas where we'll fight the Labour Party, right? You know, in parts of the North, parts of Midlands, parts of London, we are the opposition to Labour councillors and Labour MPs. And the big picture for the next general election is that we are second place in 91 seats. Of those 91 seats, 80 are currently held by the Tories. So you don't have to be a electoral wizard or a mathematical genius to realise that we want to attack the Conservative Party.
But I mean, would you consider anything more formal than that? I mean, obviously, as you say, there's seats where Labour and the Lib Dems are going to fight against each other. But to have a realistic chance of getting a majority, Labour basically need the Lib Dems to defeat the Conservatives in some other places. I mean, could you see something formal, or is it a bit too early to be able to talk about that?
I think it's way too early. However, I think the point you made then that Labour needs the Liberal Democrats to succeed is absolutely on the money. I'm ambitious for progressive politics. I'm ambitious to get rid of this Conservative government. And a Labour strategist would look at their current position, look at what's happening in Scotland, what's happening to the Red Wall in the north of England, and go, you know what? If we're going to get rid of this Conservative government, the Liberal Democrats have to be beating the Tories in a significant number of seats. And if they wake up to what I think is just the reality, whether they like it or not, it's a reality, then we're not talking to the Labour Party from a weak position. We're talking to the Labour Party, well, we have a common enemy here. It's called Boris Johnson, the Tory party. What are we going to do about it? And so it's not pacts or deals. It's just sort of an understanding, a recognition. Because we're two separate parties, right? We've got very different ideologies, but we share some common ground.
To go back to the last general election, the Liberal Democrat offering was very much heavily based around Brexit. But there's an argument that a lot of voters think Brexit is a kind of dead issue now. I mean, is it at all relevant for Lib Dems now? I mean, obviously, we've got the prospect of the transition period finishing at the end of the year without a deal. Is that something you still can and will want to fight on?
I'm a passionate pro-European, and if I win, I'll be leading a principled pro-European Liberal Democrat party. And so we're always going to argue the pro-European case. And Brexit over the next few years is going to be relevant in the context of COVID and in the context of trade deals and in the context of itself. And basically, our economy is going to be in a mess. A mess because of COVID, a mess because of Brexit, a mess because this Conservative government are making mistake after mistake. And so Brexit is part of the economic story that Liberal Democrats need to fess up to and to show we have a response to. So what I offer in the leadership is someone who's sort of been there and done that and can really offer a credible economic alternative. And it will be built round a green economy recovery plan. And when you combine the need for a real boost to the economy with the need to deal with regional inequality, with the need to tackle the climate emergency, now is the time for a scale of ambition, which is Franklin Delano Roosevelt proportions.
And then one final thing. You've also said that beyond Brexit and beyond any other things, you want the Lib Dems to become the party for social care. How will you kind of keep it in the public eye, and what are your kind of plans for it?
Well, people need to know, whether they're Liberal Democrats or not, how passionate I am about this personally. My dad died when I was 4. My mum became terminally ill when I was 12. And I nursed her with my brother as a young carer till she died when I was 15. So I've always worried about young carers in my constituency and across the country. And then I was brought up by my grandparents, and then, of course, my granddad died, and my nana became frail, and I was in charge of her care for a decade or more. And now I have a disabled son who's adorable, but he can't walk or talk, and he's got learning disabilities. So my wife and I have to care for him. He needs 24/7 care. So caring is a part of my daily life and has been a big part of my whole life. And I've seen some of the amazing things that the NHS can do. I've seen some of the weaknesses in our care system. And I am absolutely personally determined to be the voice of carers and to be a political movement which says social care has been forgotten for too long. We're not going to forget it. We're not going to stop campaigning. We will be talking about it. When everyone's talking about something else, this will be my obsession. And, you know, it's one of my objectives. I've talked about climate change as a key objective for me for all the reasons we know about. But caring and sorting out social care is an absolute passion and driving motivation for me. And I found in the leadership election lots of other Lib Dems share that view. So, you know, let's go and campaign on it. Let's campaign at local elections on it. Let's campaign on national election on it. Let us make sure we sort this thing out and the Liberal Democrats are leading, frankly, in the way that someone like Norman landed on mental health.
Ed Davies speaking to Peter Walker. And that is all from us this week. As we enter what should be a quieter time in Westminster, we've decided to use this moment to step back and look at the big picture. And with that in mind, we'll be running a mini-series throughout the month of August where I speak to several large and interesting figures in British politics to hear their personal thoughts on where we are now and what the next 12 months and beyond might bring us. Next week, I'll be speaking with Peter Mandelson about why Keir Starmer had such a monumental task on his hands to get Labour back into power.
He certainly put Labour back onto the electoral pitch. He's put us back into contention, but we are a long way from winning the next election, that's clear.
And you can hear that conversation from next Wednesday morning, so do please join us for that. But for now, a huge thanks to all of our guests, Jess Elgott, Peter Walker, Rajiv Sayal, Ed Davey and Dave Penman. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please take care of yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.